This is A Sustainable Mind, episode 82. Today we'll be speaking with Dana Simpson, an artist, author, longtime environmentalist, and climate change activist, about her new book. I just received a copy in the mail and it is beautiful. But before we get into that, I wanted to thank the sponsor of today's show, Brightmark. Brightmark is a leader in plastics renewal technology, and they aim to transform post-consumer plastics that are destined for the landfill into multiple kinds of usable resources for the future. We'll be talking a little bit more about their plastics renewal solutions a little bit later in this episode. Now, let's get into it. Welcome to A Sustainable Mind, where we delve into the minds behind today's most impactful environmental campaigns, organizations, and startups, inspiring the environmental changemakers of tomorrow. I'm your host, Marjorie Alexander. Author, illustrator, and designer Dana Simpson is a lifelong environmentalist and climate change activist. She and her husband live on the front line of climate change in a 200-year-old house on an island in the Chesapeake Bay. She keeps a tide clock on the dash of her car and gives the blue crabs and fish the right of way on her commute home. She has been a sought-after speaker and visiting professor on imagination development for the last 10 years. Currently, she is using her skill set to engage and empower people to look at climate change as an opportunity for positive change. Dana has written and illustrated 14 books and worked with many companies internationally to design home decor and many other products. She is also the illustrator for the upcoming Green Writers Press children's picture book, Janie Monarch Seed. Welcome to the show, Dana.
Well, thanks a lot. I'm pleased to be here.
Excellent, excellent. So let's get started with our very first question, the same question that we ask everyone. How did nature, the environment, and sustainability play a role in your childhood growing up?
Well, I think I was really lucky to live kind of back in the growing up in the 70s when, I don't know, our parents opened the door and they said, see ya around dinner. and I went down and I played with my friends down by the Chemung River, and a flood had come through there years ago. And so there were these kind of overgrown basements and things like that and animals everywhere. And I just loved it. And also in the 70s, the ecology movement, it was called back then, was huge because rivers were catching fire and people were coming to the realization with terrible, terrible air pollution, et cetera, that things were out of control. And of course, there was the wonderful commercial with the Indian, you know, paddling through the trash in his canoe. And then he turned to the camera with the tear going down his cheek. And that just so... I still can think of that commercial. It was a fabulous commercial, sadly put out by the plastic industry, which I'll tell you about a little later.
So do you consider that commercial to be kind of like a turn or a change in your frame of mind in terms of your life so far, in terms of wanting to get into the sustainability or the ecology movement?
Well, there's a lot of things. My parents also were very active in civil rights. And my mother was a lifelong peace activist, standing out with her sign when she was 80 years old, you know, against nuclear arms and, you know, war. So I always kind of had that going on. But my focus has always been the environment. Yes, I just, you know, maybe I was an early Buddhist. I just always felt everything was connected. And I love animals. You know, the light in nature is totally what inspires me in my work and has forever.
So in terms of your work, what kind of came first? Was it the artist and designer and illustrator side, or was it the environmental and social activism? Did they kind of dovetail? How exactly did that all come about?
I would have to say that I've always been an environmentalist kind of all through my life, focusing on what's going on with that Greenpeace and all kinds of things. And then my vocation has been art. And as an artist, you learn to look at things on many levels and from many different directions. You know, are there alternatives? Or why is this like this? Or, you know, is this beautiful? Is this not beautiful? Is it good? Is it bad? And you kind of walk through life and it's a pretty rich existence, because you're always rehashing things and thinking about what might be better. So I think the marriage of that sort of creativity with the environmental focus has spurred me on now to really put on my skill set towards working for the environment.
So this is a great segue, actually, to talk about your Coming Together handbook. Can you tell us a bit about what that is exactly, what the objectives of that handbook are, and how it came about?
Absolutely. As I said, I was trying to figure out how to use my skill set as an illustrator artist, and I felt a little overwhelmed I went to a wonderful lecture by Paul Hawken. I drove 3 hours to see it on the Western Shore of Maryland, and it was great. And I learned all about Drawdown, which is a fabulous book, and the movement, but it was full of, you know, extreme academics, people who were, you know, I just felt like as an artist, how could I ever be of use, you know? And at the end of his presentation, I was the last one to ask a question. And I said, you know, how might I be as an artist useful? And he said, you know, Dana, I don't know you, but I think you'll think of something. And at first I was like, damn it. But then I thought, you know, he's right. And I will do a book because I've done books and I've, you know, mainly been a children's book illustrator and gift books and stationery and things like that with the artwork as the main focus. But the notion of when you're an illustrator, the deal is you want to bring the reader into the concept. Yeah. And I used to be a political cartoonist too. Same thing. You know, you use that illustration, that sense of humor to kind of come around back and bring the person into the idea. And that is why I thought I'm going to make a book about climate change that is uplifting, positive, engaging, because the majority of the books are so, gosh, they're just devastating, you know, yeah. And it turns people off and people feel overwhelmed and thrown down, you know, just how can I possibly do anything? But it's tiny steps, just like anything. And that is what this book is. It's 172 pages of going forward and, you know, doing this and doing that in a slightly different way. It's not hard at all. It's probably cheaper. It's definitely healthier. And it's, you know, it's fun. It's kind of cool. And you have a real proud factor when you, you know, you come home from the grocery store and you have no plastic.
Oh, isn't that an amazing feeling?
Yeah, that's a big game. There should be a video game for that, actually. It's not easy.
Yeah, you're right. It's absolutely not easy. And, you know, I just moved to a new city and trying to figure out where all of the, you know, the stores that I need to go to on a regular basis are and the things that I can't get locally. How can I order those things online, but make sure that the packaging is minimal? And you're right. It is a really big, you know, real life game that we have to play. And I feel like there are some video game companies out there that are trying to gamify environmental sustainability so people can really understand kind of the impact from a numbers perspective. But I wanted to talk in general about the impact that something like an illustration can have. You've been an artist for many, many years. And in terms of the impact that this book is going to have or the reactions that you've gotten from the handbook so far, how do you feel as though people are able to connect with the content differently because of how it's presented?
Well, you know, when you're reading through a book that is just text and type, it better be written well or else it's a slog. So I'm hoping that my writing is not a slog, but also you get rewarded by these illustrations, you know, every other page, just little line drawings to sort of lighten it and make the read really easy. I've had people say that, wow, I just sat down and I read through your book in one night, which wow. I thought was an intense compliment because I want people to read through it. I mean, and it's funny because it's a little bit a combination between, I wouldn't say a story, but you know, there's some engaging little anecdotes in it, but it's like a recipe book for what to do. So that's usually not something someone would read through. So that was nice. They said that.
What's one example of a story or an anecdote that you shared in the book? What's one of your favorites?
Oh my gosh, there's so many. I'm trying.
I know
to
it's 130
stuff.
Plus pages. It's kind of a mean thing that I just did to you there, making you pick one.
But you know what? One did pop in my head, so that's good. And you know, you spoke about moving, and that's a daunting thing when you get to a new place. Well, picture this: we were living in New York City in our early 20s, and we moved to the Chesapeake Bay, where we moved to a little town called Frenchtown, where all of the people in the town, and there were maybe 14 houses, their last name was French. Mm. Okay. So that's my neighbors. They had been there a long time, but we bought a beaten down house on the water. This is pretty crazy, for $12,000.
Wow. Now gosh.
I know. We did have a kitchen demolition party, and the kitchen fell down before we could take the pictures. So that also gives you a little bit of knowledge as to the state the house was in. But anyways, the majority of my neighbors worked the water. So they were called watermen. And they had been there for years and years and years. They kind of took the bay and this beautiful landscape for granted, and they littered like mad.
Oh, no.
So I would kind of go down the road and I'd pick up all the litter, and then I put signs up that said, please don't litter, which they thought, oh my God, this come here. She is so uppity, you know. And this one time, this guy like stopped his pickup truck full of trash and he goes, why don't you just go back up on that hill that you come down from, like that. I was like, oh my goodness. And I just said, you know, this is beautiful where we live. You know, we need to take care of it. And, you know, and he said, you know, my daddy plundered the bay, my granddaddy plundered the bay, and I'm going to plunder the bay. Like, he literally said that. And I thought, wow. Okay, that's
interesting choice of words, right?
Yeah. And so you've got people who are in that mindset, and therefore you have to, like, the first chapter of the book is actually about how to talk to people, mm-hmm. and engage them so you can actually, you know, have a conversation and not get into it with them, because it is interesting and sometimes frightening to hear how people think. But in order to move forward together, you know, I try to imagine myself in his shoes. And then I was like, okay, I see that. How can I change his vision on that? And, you know, 20 years later, there is less garbage around. The local folks understand that. But hopefully some wonderful things that were in place maybe 20, 30 years ago, like giving a couple cents back for aluminum cans, which are invaluable, and glass, might be reinstituted to help people maybe not litter so much.
Mm-hmm. So you brought up something interesting, which is, you know, how to speak to people about difficult topics in general, but specifically when it comes to the environment and the role that we play in the larger ecosystem. What are some tips that you can give our listeners that would be beneficial in interacting with our neighbors and other people in our community that might not be so aware or might be even a little bit resistant to changing their everyday habits in a way that would benefit our environment?
All right. It's you never want to be preachy. And so anytime you begin to talk at somebody about what they should be doing, it's not going to work. But what does work is action. So when I go in the grocery store, if I have my market bags, and in a lot of places, market bags are de rigueur. Everyone has them. Mm-hmm. Everybody's on that bus, which is great. Not where I live. You know, I'm kind of in a little backwater. So I can still walk into a grocery store and the cashier, the line kind of grinds to a halt. And the cashier looks at me with horror because she's all set up to like slam my groceries into these plastic bags.
Right.
And I said, hey, I'll just run down to the end of the checkout thing and I'll be glad to pack. Thank you so much for helping me out with this. So number one, you know, pour it on, understand their position. And, you know, then as you're packing, it's also great because you can put what you want together. So that's kind of a plus to packing your own groceries and bringing your own bags. And then the people behind you in the line are like, oh, yeah, man, I wish I brought my bags. Mm-hmm. So a dialogue starts, and just have it be a positive dialogue. And yet like, yeah, oh my gosh, I forget mine all the time too. And, you know, it's just something we're all working toward. And when you leave, you've impacted two or three people around you. So the more we just lead by doing, you know, that's golden.
So talking about the larger picture, actually, and I'm just curious, I actually lived in Maryland for many years, went to middle school and high school there, and my family still lives there. Living on the Bay, what exactly have you seen in terms of the environmental impacts of over the last several decades? Like, what has that actually looked like? What have you seen, you know, year to year or season to season, the changes in the Bay, or, you know, the first frost, for instance? I don't know if you're a gardener, but, you know, the change in the months and when it starts to get cold versus when it starts to get warm again, and does it rain more often than it used to? Are there more, you know, like, what does that look like in your environment?
Well, I'm sorry to tell you, all of the above. And it's quite amazing, because we've lived in our current house about 20 years, and the water's higher. Mm-hmm. There was like a row of beautiful, huge, big pine trees, and the bluff has been undermined. I expect we've lost at least 10 feet in.
Wow.
Yeah. And probably since Hurricane Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
And all the trees are like laying over, and it's just this march forward of the water. There's also saltwater encroachment. We live on an island, so we kind of have well water. So we haul our water. I don't know what's going to happen when we get to be decrepit old people. We haul these big bottles of water down to the house. And in terms of my garden, and I am a gardener and I love to garden, I've rigged up this entire situation with cattle troughs and big vessels to capture the rainwater when it rains. And then I literally hand carry my watering cans around and water everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty wild. And in terms of winter, my gosh, when we first moved here, the entire Chesapeake Bay would freeze over in the winter.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, sometimes for weeks. And I recall looking out the window and it would be, you know, sloshing around waves. And then maybe about 6-7 hours later, frozen. Mm-hmm. So it barely ever freezes anymore. In fact, last winter, I think in February, I was thinking, my goodness, should I start a garden? Because it was so warm. I was really thrown off. So yeah, the weather patterns have also changed. It's quite a bit more rainy here now. You might have noticed that. East Coast is getting a lot more rain, West Coast less.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, I do remember a lot of those things. My grandparents, for the duration of, you know, since I was born, have always been in Maryland. So even though I moved to Maryland when I was 10, I've been, you know, visiting my entire life. And I have definitely noticed literally all of the things that you're mentioning. And I don't know what it's like living in the middle of the country, but I would assume that no matter where you live, there is something, although it's different for everyone, depending on where you are, there are things that have swung wildly in one direction or another. So, and I know that you living right on, you know, the Bay is a very, it's a susceptible environment, I guess.
It sure
is.
It's
a highly susceptible environment. So the changes are even more dramatic.
Yes. Yeah. But I guess I would opt for, you know, high tides and the occasional hurricane over the tornadoes. Tornadoes mm-hmm. really scare me. Although there have been some in Maryland lately.
Yeah. I've noticed that. It's crazy.
Yeah. Back to the water. I probably should have said, since you were talking about my tide clock in my car, that is such a challenge for us. We love our house. We love where we live, but how we get here is there's a sandy road that winds out through the marsh and we can come home and it will be under, like a foot under. So you cannot drive. So I've drive through water. I'm pretty brave/bad about that, because it's certainly not great for your car. Because if I want to get home, I do it. But sometimes it's so high. We have literally had to, like, at the end of the road, try to sleep a few hours in the car, and you know, maybe the tide will go down and we'll get out there. But that is going to be a real problem for us. I'm just waiting for somebody to hurry up and design a car that goes through water, since so many people live on the water, you know,
yeah.
And I'll buy one right now.
Well, we have, you know, when you go to these coastal cities, sometimes they'll have those big tourist vehicles that, you know, they turn into a boat and then they have these big old tires and then they'll come back onto land. I don't remember what they're called, but I feel like I might have ridden in one of those once. So yeah, maybe if somebody can make a regular like consumer smaller version of that, that could be actually really useful. But again, I mean, the fact that we need that is actually kind of sad. And that brings me to an interesting point. You know, like I said, you're in a highly susceptible environment when it comes to climate change. And I think a lot of people feel as though climate change happens like out there. You know, it happens in developing countries and it happens on the Gulf of Mexico and it might happen, you know, on both coasts of Florida. But, you know, here in the United States, we are getting impacted by this more and more and more. And you living in the community where you are, where the world view might not be so open to, hey, the world is changing rapidly, it's warming rapidly, and we need to do something about it. How are people reacting to that in your community? Do they bring it up? Do they kind of, you know, complain about it on the one hand, but also I'm not going to change my behaviors on the other hand? How are you seeing that people are really interacting with their environment differently? And is that changing the way that they think about it?
Well, with water, you just don't have a choice.
Yeah.
So what we've got here, which is beautiful, is a lot of water. But this water also is already pretty much putting Smith Island at risk, which is a large island with a lot of people on it. And Tangier Island, same. People are going to lose their towns.
Yeah.
And Crisfield, Maryland, which is very close to us, the main street will just go under. And people have invested a lot of money in apartment buildings down there, you know, trying to slick it up and whatnot. And it's at a certain point, you can't fight a force like that. So yeah, we have to somehow embrace it mm-hmm. and live with it. And as much as we love living here, at some point, we might not be able to stay here.
Right.
There's a great movie, my favorite movie, as a matter of fact, The Beasts of the Southern Wild. Have you ever seen it?
No, but somehow that sounds familiar. Say the name again.
Beasts of a Southern Wild. It is fabulous. And it's about down in Louisiana, and it's about the people who are being displaced by all of the dikes and things that they're putting up to save, you know, the more wealthier sections of New Orleans and things. And these people are just left out. It's such a good movie. And the soundtrack is beautiful as well.
Ooh, I'm a sucker for a good movie soundtrack. So I'm going to have to check that out in the next few weeks here. So you talk about, you know, at some point possibly not being able to stay where you live. And unfortunately, I think if people are really paying attention, they'll know that there is a certain amount of baked in warming, and climate projections in the past, you know, decade plus, we're learning at this point, have been really off. And we possibly, I hate to be a downer, but have a little less time to address these things than we thought. And there's actually an episode, dozens of episodes ago, on adaptation as opposed to sustainability, right? Because, you know, for you to sustain something, hopefully the thing that you're sustaining is a state that you actually like. We don't like the state that we're in right now. So, you know, what's the line between sustainability and adaptation? And that episode, I think we talk a lot about, you know, it's not necessarily one versus the other and you switch back and there's no return, but really how they dovetail. I wanted to talk to you about what exactly makes the Come Together handbook different than other climate change books, and how is it going to help, you know, lift us out of this? How is it going to change people's perception about their mindset, their everyday actions, and how they interact with others in their community to find solutions?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. The difference is that the books about climate change and global warming are downers, and you're left at the end of the book saying, we're screwed, you know, and... Instead of that, I really don't like to leave the party with people feeling like that. So this book says, hey, you know what? This is an opportunity for us. And really, the pandemic, as bad as it is and as frightening as it is, has showed us a lot of things. We don't have to drive to work every day. Mm-hmm. Look how we're adapting now.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been this surge in baking bread. Well done. You know what? Every time you bake a loaf, you're not buying a loaf mm-hmm. that's in plastic. Right. And in the book, that's my favorite part. The book covers a lot of stuff, like how you can go through room by room and make everything more sustainable, reduce clutter and things like that. But my favorite part in the next book is going to augment this whole thing is the recipes. Big corporations are making all the products and foods and hair care products, cleaning things right now, mm-hmm. but they've got a recipe. Mm. It's not that hard. And in fact, if you go back to like 1960, 1950, and before that, everybody was pretty much making a lot of the stuff that they used to keep their houses clean, their bodies clean, themselves. And it's all from some very simple ingredients, like, for instance, baking soda, vinegar, essential oils are great. And the recipes are amazingly simple. Like, for instance, you can make a mouthwash from baking soda, tea tree oil, peppermint oil, and distilled water. Mm. And it's so good for your mouth because in the book, it talks about Listerine. Listerine was originally invented by a guy named Joseph Lister as floor cleaner. He was a surgeon. He wanted, you know, his place where he was opening up people to be clean. And so they marketed it like that. But then they also marketed it as a toothpaste down the line here, and or not toothpaste, a mouthwash. But what it does is it scours the inside of your mouth and it kills everything that's in there. Mm-hmm. And just like your garden, there's beneficial insects and beneficial bacteria. And then there's stuff that, you know, contributes to gingivitis, etc. So when you use a thing like Listerine, it's going to knock out everything. So you have to continually use a product like that or purchase another product to kind of balance your mouth back out again. And if you can, here's the part where I really wish I could hold up the Listerine bottle, which people probably go through a bottle of Listerine in a week and a half. This is a big plastic bottle. And what do? You throw it out. Mm-hmm. So there's so many products like that, from condiments, ketchup, mustard, simple to make. I make my own toothpaste and it's great. And that stream of plastic, and that's really the big takeaway here. If everybody tomorrow said, I'm going to try to buy in bulk, I'm going to carry my glass jars into the grocery store, if grocery stores would be so kind as to have a great bulk section for everybody.
Yes.
You know, and I'm going to make stuff. It doesn't take that long at all, actually. And once you kind of get in the groove, it's just sort of part of your day. And making stuff is good for you. It's very centering. And I think that, young people now struggle with a lot of depression and anxiety. I think it's because they feel like things are out of control, out of hand.
Yes.
The more you bring it back in, that is very empowering and calming and centering, and it instills a certain confidence and really a joy of life.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm really excited to get my hands on this handbook. So let's tell people how they can get a copy. Where is it available? And is there a PDF version that's available for people that might not want to get the printed version?
Yep. There's an ebook. And you can go to Green Writers Press, or you're also welcome to come to my website. And that is D-A-N-A Simpson. So it's danasimpson.com. And there's a bunch of other stuff on there because I do artwork and handmade ceramics and stuff. But if you go to the stationery section, you'll see the books right there. So you can order them through me as well.
Excellent. Excellent. And just a note, Dana Simpson is spelled with no P, S-I-M-S-O-N. So danasimpson.com, sans the P.
I give you 100 points for doing that. Thank you. You just saved the entire interview right there. Well done.
So before we get into our 7 sustainable questions, let's hear a quick word from our sponsor. If you've been listening to A Sustainable Mind for a while, then you may have gathered that when it comes to climate change, there are no perfect nor immediate solutions.
we've created a monumental challenge in climate change over the course of decades. And it's a problem that will take the brightest minds and an incredibly strong commitment from hundreds of millions of people over many years to solve. Today's episode is brought to you by Brightmark. Here's one fact for you. 91% of plastics in the United States are not recycled. There are solutions happening at all levels of this problem, and Brightmark is a company that is focusing on creative solutions to tackle the plastics that are already in our waste stream. Whether these items wind up in our waterways or heaped up in landfills, Brightmark aims to collect these plastics and transform them into useful outputs. Plastic renewal is Brightmark's claim to fame. They utilize those traditional non-recyclable plastics, the ones with numbers 3 through 7 on them, and turn them into renewed plastics that can be used for new products. Brightmark is helping us tackle a problem that is already on our hands, and you can learn more about Brightmark and their plastics renewal technology at brightmark.com and in episode 81 of A Sustainable Mind, where we chat with their CEO, Bob Powell, about these plastic waste solutions and the company's plans for the future. Thank you so much, Brightmark, for sponsoring today's episode. And now let's get back to our 7 sustainable questions.
Dana, can you share with us one long-standing habit that you believe has significantly improved your life?
Yep, and that's back to the bread. When I became, in my teenage years, I started baking bread. And it's easy, you know, and I have a super easy recipe that I can say right now. It's 3.5 cups of flour, 1.5 cups of warm water, 1 teaspoon of sugar, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and 1 teaspoon of yeast. And you can, in the flour, you can put some flaxseed in, like maybe 1/4 cup. You can change some of the flour to whole wheat. You just mix that up in the morning, knead it a little bit, put it on your counter, and leave it at the end of the day before dinner. Turn your oven on to 425, pop it in there with a little pot of water. This is kind of the fun part. You keep a metal bowl in the bottom of your oven. So when it's up to 425, you put your bread in and then you pour some water in the metal bowl and it goes swoosh and all this steam comes up and it makes an awesome crusty bread.
Nice.
Yeah.
And this is actually fantastic for when my sourdough starter dies and I'm still in the mood for bread and don't want to leave the house. So
absolutely. Yeah, it's super easy. Yep. I love it. And see, then that whole making it thing, that is what really has driven me my entire life. Like if there's a thing to do, I'm like, well, can I do it? Well, why don't I just do it?
Yeah. Wow. Very cool. So share with us one new habit that you're cultivating in your life right now.
Well, after I saw the movie, which I'm going to recommend another movie here, The Story of Plastic, I think Oceana might be behind it. I'm not sure, but it is a great documentary and extremely unsettling. You will really run screaming from the grocery store after that. I'm really trying to stay away from plastic and figure out alternatives and really spread the word about that, because it's crunch time on that one. And very quickly, the fossil fuel companies, plastic is their plan B. Plastic's made from fossil fuels. They're not selling a whole lot of gas right now.
Mm-hmm.
So they are pushing plastic. And if you look now, vegetables are being wrapped in plastic.
Oh my gosh. Individual apples. Oh my God. It drives me nuts.
Yeah. And that's the fossil fuels leaning hard on the grocery store. So what we have to do, we're the consumers, we're the people who vote with our buck. We need to not buy those. And we need to march right into the grocery store manager and say, could you please like ease up on the plastic? We just want the vegetables, you know, that's what we have to do. Cause right now they're shoving it down our throat and we need to turn that around and demand what we want.
So speaking of buying things and making things, what is one thing that people would actually be surprised that they can make at home? I know that I totally just sprung that on you.
No, it's okay. The problem is like about 350.
Oh, wow.
Things. Okay. Just so many things. I'll give you a good one. Right now, we got a pandemic, got to wash your hands, right? When you go into the grocery store, wherever, and you buy one of those little hand soap washer things, it's okay, that is one use plastic. And all you're doing is you're spending a lot of money for water, because how you make that is you would just take some Castile soap. You can buy it in a bar. Dr. Bronner's is a Castile soap. You mix a little bit of that with water, shake it up. And, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of essential oil in it, some, you know, stuff like that. That's it. So you're spending what, $2 or $3 for something you're going to then throw out and contribute to the plastic problem. And you could have made that. Like, you can save all of your little pump things instead of, you know, throwing them out.
Right.
And make your own hand soap, give it to your friends with the recipe on it. And, you know, what a nice gift.
That is a fantastic gift. How cool.
And you're spreading the word.
Right. And it makes a good gift, because I'm not the best gift giver. Like, I'm a really good gift giver with things that I make, but in terms of like buying things, because people ask me and I'm like, you're the person that has everything, what do I give you? This is perfect. This is absolutely a perfect gift.
Well, and the more we, you know, it's hard to buy stuff anyways. The more we kind of use what you got, that's another kind of mantra of mine. That's an important thing to do, because I'm sorry to say it, because I know everybody is really addicted, but Amazon,
oh, I know,
it's very, very bad. Yeah. All the packing, all the boxes, all of the emissions, and then people are returning stuff. So it goes back. And if you can possibly buy it locally, and maybe it costs a couple dollars more, in the scheme of things, we're paying a lot for, you know, end of use garbage.
Mm-hmm. So you have had a big impact on your community, on your readers, and of the people that have purchased your art or seen your, you know, political cartoons and in publications. In terms of the environmental work of others, whose environmental work do you admire?
Well, I'll go back to Paul Hawken. I mean, he started out with Smith and Hawken, and I think even before that, he did the Whole Earth catalog way back in the day, which was this huge collection of everything you need. Is great. I mean, I wish somebody else would do that. You know, that I think were sustainable things, because it is really interesting that back there in the 70s, people were very, very mindful about the environment. And then we sort of fell away from it and got very consumptive and thing oriented. And I really hope that we're going to go back to that mindset. So he's a wonderful guy. And he was amazing when I went to go see this lecture, because there was a lot of technical stuff and he just rattled it off. A very impressive man, because I think he's probably easily, you know, I don't want to insult him, but he's older. I'm just going to say that, you know, and he did great. And he's doing it, you know, he's out there, he's pushing the agenda and doing good things. So I very much admire him. And then I will have to say, in the past year or two, I've been working with a lot of local environmental groups like Climate Action Network, Climate Change Action Network, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, you know, Surf Riders. There's a million of them. And that's just a pile of dedicated people all working super hard. And you got to love that.
Absolutely. So let's talk about resources for one quick second. Do you have an internet resource that you find helpful on a regular basis that you think would be beneficial to share with our listeners?
Well, in the back of the Come Together, there's two pages of resources, and that does not cover it. But, you know, everything from 350.org, Earth Justice, Sierra Club, Oceana, and then, you know, repair.org, you've got something broken, go there. They might help you fix it. There's wonderful websites for what can be recycled. And here's a whole nother show for you. The recycling thing, it's like Thank You for Smoking is another movie where it was the marketing of the tobacco companies, you know, to kind of like spin the message. Recycling was a way to make us feel good about buying more plastic. Because you really can't recycle. We're not recycling right now. That's why we have to turn off the faucet of plastic.
That's a wonderful way to put it, by the way. Turn off the faucet of plastic. I like that.
I stole that from Oceana. I'll give them credit. And you get that. That's an illustration, you know? So that's what you got to go right back with the tubs overflowing. You turn off the faucet. You don't start trying to bail out the tub. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in terms of food, that's another way to, the book is so packed because climate change is not a single source problem. It is a result of so many things that we're doing. And I, you know, I'm sorry to say wrong. Let's say instead, you know, not sustainably, we'll say that. But, you know, there's food waste, slow food, eatwild.com, you know, and then I have to jump over and we need to have a long-term vision in terms of our population. Planned Parenthood is very good. We have to treat each other kindly. Southern Poverty Law Center, awesome people. Mm. Habitat for Humanity. I mean, it's, yeah, as you can see,
there's
a lot of great ones out there. And aren't we lucky that they are?
Absolutely. You are absolutely right. There are so many organizations and so many people that are really doing the hard work for us, doing all of the research and, you know, putting these things together, putting them in a nice, neat, compact package and handing them to us and saying, here you go, steps A to Z, you know.
That's so right.
We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We just need to find the people that are already doing the work and we just follow their example. So thank you for all of those. And if people want access to literally everything that you just listed, I'll have that listed in the show description for this episode. As always, you can grab that in the show description on your device or head on over to our website, asustainablemind.com. And of course, grab your copy of the Come Together Handbook where you can get the entire list. But speaking of other books, what book would you recommend to sustainable minds out there that are hoping to shift their mindset to become the change that they want to see in the world?
Well, Paul Hawken's going to love me because I'm going to say Drawdown.
Yeah.
And I think they've just come out with another edition. But that is also a very, very positive look at what we're doing. And there's some exciting things. Biomimicry. Oh, I love that. And, you know, things from a very academic and inventive and scholarly, you know, level all the way down to women empowering them in third world countries so that they can, you know, live more sustainably and start a trend away from habits that are poison the earth and are not beneficial to their communities either.
Yeah. So I do want to end on an interesting and hopefully fun note. If you could be any creature from your home habitat, the Chesapeake Bay, what would it be and why?
That's the hardest question right there. I mean, seriously. And I have a lot of wonderful friends out here, my furry and feathered creatures. Oh my. And it's a gift when I stumble on an owl or any of them. We have a lot of bald eagles, but you know, the eagles are a little bit of a bully. So I'm going to go with the osprey. Ospreys are beautiful, beautiful birds. And I love them. I love their song. And so I'll say that, but I'd be happy to come back as any of them.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you, Dana, so much for joining us. Again, if you are interested in getting your hands on the Come Together Handbook, please check out greenwriterspress.com or go directly to Dana's website, Dana Simpson, DanaSimson.com. By the way, this cover of this book is beautiful. So kudos to you for doing that. You did this illustration, right? I'm assuming.
I did. And I'm really glad you mentioned it because I had done this painting, I don't know, a little while ago, but it's so appropriate for this book. The name of it is Love is Symmetrical. Mm. So if we love the world, if we love the earth, if we love wildlife and nature, it's going to love us back.
Well, you know, I can't even ask my final question that I usually ask. Do you have any final words or parting pieces of guidance to share with people? Because I think that that is literally the best note that we could have ended on. Dana, thank you so, so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. I've had a great time.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode. If you want to learn more about Dana and the Come Together Handbook, head on over to danasimpson.com. That's spelled danasimson.com. Or you can get this link and all of the resources mentioned in today's episode at asustainablemind.com/082. Also, don't forget about Mass Eco Live, coming to you this April 30th through May 2nd, 2021. This will be a free, yes, the event is now free, 3-day event filled with keynotes, workshops, and panel discussions. To grab your free ticket, head on over to masseco-live.com. That is masseco-live.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll catch you next time on A Sustainable Mind.